House Rules Committee to order, and we are opening a public hearing of HJM 15. I invite Representative Clem. If he's prepared.
I think I'm supposed to wait for Representative Boyle to finish.
Oh, okay.
Upstairs.
Okay.
And we will.
Okay, so I will temporarily close the public hearing on HJM 15. And we now open a public hearing on House Bill 3500. And Representative Gallegos is invited to testify. Which one?
3506.
Okay.
Just gonna get. Hello, Tiffany?
Yeah.
Hi, Tiffany. This is Erin Seiler from the House Rules Committee. We just opened a public hearing on House Bill 3500. Chair Hicks is here, and Representative Gallegos is just beginning to testify. So if you just want to hang on and listen for a second, we will have you give your testimony in just 1 second.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Hicks, Vice Chair, that aren't here, members of the committee, I am very pleased to present this bill to you this morning, and or this afternoon, I should say.
And so also, please start with your name, Representative.
Yes, I will. My name is Joseph Gallegos. I am the representative for House District 30, which is North Hillsborough and North Plains, part of Washington County. I want to thank you very much for allowing us to testify this afternoon and tell you the story of this young mother and her child. I bring for you House Bill 3500, a bill that would require washing machines in Oregon to have warning labels to not allow children near the top of the washing machines. Colleagues, if we can prevent the death of one more child, then as stewards of our citizens, we have done our job. Tiffany Hebe is my constituent. She contacted our office with a story that brought tears even to the staffer who took the call. The Huffington Post describes this tale. At 21 months, Ollie Hebe was his mother's helper on laundry day, climbing atop a bin so he could toss clothes into the top-loading washer. On the morning he went missing for a few minutes, Tiffany Hebe went through her house calling for him but got no answer. She found the toddler in the washing machine, submerged in a full tub. He died a day later. His mother recently moved to Oregon from Utah and says that she never thought the washing machine would be a danger to her child and is telling the story to help make other parents aware of the danger. The same Huffington Post article also reported that 5 children have died or had died in the same manner between 2005 and 2009. So it hurts my heart to tell you that Ollie, a young constituent of mine, makes that number 6. Another report done 10 years ago by the Consumer Public Product Safety Commission cited 496 washing machine-related injuries to children. Now, Tiffany and her husband, Chris, are on a mission to educate parents about the danger of the seemingly innocuous household appliance. To do that, they turned to us, their state representatives, with an idea that could save the lives of future children. The bill was actually initiated by my Republican predecessor, the good Representative Sean Lindsay from the Silicon Valley. I'm proud to continue the work that and bring this bill to you. Colleague, there's nothing so tragic, and there's nothing so tragic as losing a child. I myself have lost 2 babies who never had the chance to grow up even into childhood. We regularly pass resolutions that honor our heroes. We will never know if little Ollie might not have grown up to be one of those heroes. Colleagues, I know that no matter what we do today, young people will still commit suicide. People will continue to drink themselves to death. and spouses will continue to batter their partners. However, today we have the opportunity to start a conversation on a measure that could prevent the death of another child in a washing machine accident. Colleagues, I ask you to look inside your heart today and support House Bill 3500 with a work session and then a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Okay, we're going to call our next witness.
Hello?
Tiffany?
Yes.
Sorry about that. If you want to just give your name for the record, and please go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, this is Tiffany Hebb. Dear Chair and members of the House Committee on Rules, I'm a resident of House District 30. I first want to thank you for taking the time to touch on my story and hear what I have to say. On March 23rd, 2012, at approximately 10 a.m., my life was changed by the tragic death of my two-year-old son, Ollie. We were happily doing laundry together, as we always did. We both were enjoying each other's company, but for some reason, he still wanted to help me with the laundry. When I went into the other room, he went back in and climbed up on top of my washing machine. He fell in and drowned. I had never thought of this to be a danger in my home, a seemingly innocuous household appliance. Since that day, I've been trying to warn other parents about this danger. I have talked to numerous age groups of people about this accident and have found that the majority of people don't think of the washing machine to be a risk to the lives of our young ones. Everyone is aware about water in the toilet, a bucket, swimming pool, and a tub, but not a washing machine. So we need to bring attention to the washing machine. My son is not the only child who has died by falling into a washing machine, but one death is too many, one too many. And I have also heard of many other instances of severe injuries caused from the washing machine. Representative Gallegos and his team have been helping me to write a bill for a warning label to be placed on all washing machines in the state of Oregon. If I could help save just one child, then this bill would be worth it to me. Members of the Committee on House Rules, I plead that you look into your hearts today and imagine losing your precious child. I thank you for your time and ask a work session to be scheduled to help further the bill. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hebb. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I don't see any. So, well, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hebb.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
That's it.
I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3500, and I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 3506, and I call Representative Gallegos and Secretary of State Kate Brown.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3506 requires Secretary of State and county clerks to provide voting materials in language other than English to minority language speakers in counties in which either 5% of the population or 10% of citizens are members of a single language minority community. Requires Secretary of State to allow electors to register as member of language minority community on voter registration website.
Chairman Hicks, committee members, I come today to testify I'm still Joseph Gallegos, House District 30, Hillsborough, and North Plains. So this is House Bill 3506 relating to bilingual voting requirements. During the fall when I was running for office, I knocked on a lot of constituent doors and talking to them about the upcoming elections. Several times I ran into a number of my constituents whose primary language was not English, and in some cases it proved to be a language barrier. It made me question their ability, really, of reading the ballots, reading the voters' pamphlets, understanding deadlines, and fully participating in the electoral process. So I hope that most of us, if not all of us in the building, can agree that all citizens have the right to vote, and I should hope that we can all agree that they should be able to do so in the language that they are comfortable in and understand most fully. After noticing this difficulty, I looked up the federal policy with regard to requirements for making non-English voting materials available. Basically, the feds require a voting district to have like a 5% minority population and a literacy rate that is greater than the national average. And to me, the adult literacy rate is an unnecessary metric for assessing this issue. Literacy rates stem from a variety of issues, but not exclusive to what a person's first language may be. So what is proposed in 3506 is a fair way of fixing an obvious problem that we have across the state. It's a lofty goal proposed in this bill. I've reached out to the Association of County Clerks, spoken with the president of Benton County Clerks and their legislative board members in Washington, Multnomah, Cook, Josephine counties, and those who represent them through the Association of Oregon Counties. And I want to be clear that none has given their endorsement of the current form of the bill, but none has expressed opposition either. And I've conferred with the secretary and I've been in communication with her staff on more than one occasion regarding this bill. And again, there's no opposition to this bill or to the concept, there has been support for it. We all recognize that citizens' rights to vote and to do so in a way that best fits their understandings. While counties and the secretary do not specifically endorse the bill in its current form, both parties have given their feedback on the bill. They have concerns about what the transition might look like. There are many questions on how to best have the translations done. When will citizens first be able to access the information in the language they choose? And how will this affect the communication between the Secretary of State's office and the hardworking clerk's offices around the state? I take their feedback to heart, as they are the people who actually do this work from day to day. The Association of Counties, County and Secretary Brown's office have committed to work with me on the current bill in drafting an amendment that will incorporate the feedback of all the stakeholders, whether it's the Secretary of State, the Office of County Clerks, or all the voting citizens. So we come together to recognize a need for a change in the system, and together along with other stakeholders, we would work to find the best next step in creating a plan that will work for everyone involved. And just, you know, to summarize, basically what it's about is really wanting to take a systemic approach to developing a comprehensive resolution to really enfranchising groups that are out there of citizens. And these are citizens who don't have English as a primary language. And if you were outside today, you heard the governor specifically say and talk about really enfranchising and getting people involved in the democratic process, regardless of what language they speak. And that's what this bill is about.
Thank you. For the record, Secretary of State Kate Brown, appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of House Bill 3506. It's my goal to make voting as accessible as possible for all eligible Oregonians, and I think this bill moves us in the direction of the bill. We would love to achieve the goals of the bill. I think it's going to take a little bit of time, some resources, and a lot of creativity. And I just want to share some of the projects that we've worked on over the last couple of years. I think to move the state in the direction that Representative Gallegos would like to see us go in. First of all, working with a number of partners, the Center for Intercultural Organizing, Oregon Voice, Opano, and Causa, we developed a new program called the New American Voters Project. The goal is to educate and engage newly naturalized citizens at the time they become sworn in, become new citizens. The project's been up and running for over a year. We've had a 90% voter registration rate, which is amazing. And it's the community groups that run the project, and as a result, it's been extremely successful and pretty minimal cost. I'm very pleased to report that that project is going to go to other states as well. We're working with Nevada and Georgia to expand the efforts of that work. The other work I just want to share is our work with tablet technology. And I think about 2 years ago, we piloted the use of tablet technology for voters with disabilities during the first congressional special election. And I actually got to go out to the assisted living facilities and watch primarily seniors use the tablet technology, not to, I don't want to panic you, but using tablet technology as a tool to mark a ballot. And it was really neat to see the seniors who many of hadn't actually used computers be very excited about the, we were using iPad technology at the time. Why should you all care about this? Because I think we have only reached the tip of the iceberg in terms of the technology and its accessibility for voters with different needs. So, for example, my vision is that we would use tablet technology to translate not only your ballot in many different languages, but the voter's pamphlet as well. Again, you have to be with the tablet, so it's not going to be as accessible as our vote-by-mail system, but I think that would be a wonderful tool to use tablet technology to translate a ballot, a voter's pamphlet, in multiple different languages that a constituent might need. The third experience I just want to share is time I spent at a phone bank run by APANA, which is the Asian Pacific Islander organization in the state of Oregon. And this was really actually a wonderful experience, and I don't know if some of you have been, but it was really neat to see. They had about 20 people calling and reaching out to folks in the community, but if they had someone who had a whose native language was Thai, the Thai speaker in the room would run over to that particular phone, and if there was someone whose native language was Mandarin, they would provide the Mandarin speaker on the phone to that particular voter. So it's a pretty, as you can see, very labor-intensive effort. It's truly a labor of love. But it really made a huge difference to those voters to be able to talk with someone in their first language and discuss whatever issues they need to discuss at the time. So those are three examples of the work I see happening throughout Oregon. I would like to work with Representative Gallegos, our counties, and the community organizations to implement his goal, which is essentially to make sure that voting is accessible as possible for every single eligible Oregonian. We see this probably moving forward in the form of a task force, but we are open to any suggestions and ideas that the committee might have. Thank you very much. I'm very delighted to be here with you today and appreciate the opportunity.
Are there questions for these witnesses? Representative Denborough.
Yeah, a couple.
Oh, Representative Verber.
Thank you, particularly Secretary Brown, for talking about the possibilities under, you know, the kind of the new technology. I speak minimal Spanish, and I think I could probably pretty easily get through a ballot. It's a list of names, and that's easy. The tough part is what happens before you get to the ballot and understanding all that you need to. And so I unfortunately my computer died, so I'm not reading the bill, but I think you've hit on the important thing is how do you get that information. And what you haven't mentioned, but which I would like to bring forward, is it's who does the translating and what do they say and how do you know that it is an accurate representation of the argument, say, in the voter's pamphlet or whatever. And these are the hard things that will have to be worked through. I totally support your goals here in helping people understand the ballots, but there's some integrity pieces that are really important here, too, in terms of the fine line between persuasion and translation, and translation's hard anyway.
Yeah.
So I know you've thought of these things, and I just bring them forward.
Thank you, Representative Berger, Chairman Hicks. You know, I think you're right. Basically, that's the intent. Then is really to really dig in and do this right. And it's not just the tablets. I think we were talking about web pages. And so really look at it, what are the various medias that we can really employ with this project. So, yeah, very exciting, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I would totally agree that it's the voter's pamphlet that's the key, and what level of translation and how do you provide the translation in a way that makes sure it's accurate. So, yes, definitely.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Chair Hicks. First of all, let me say I did have the good fortune of being part of one of those APANO phone banks. They were nonpartisan. It was a get-out-the-vote. But there were a number of people who had questions just about the mechanics of voting, and having someone able to walk them through that in their own language really did help. It was a very special night for me. I just have a question that sort of demographic question. How many counties do you think have qualifying population for this? And are there, I mean, obviously Spanish jumps to the fore. Are there any other languages that could hit that level? Thank you.
Representative Dumbrow and Chair Hicks. I count 12 that were listed for Spanish, and then Multnomah County has Vietnamese with 600 people, with Russian and Chinese as well. So these are just, again, just for preliminary, it was primarily Spanish, and we didn't ask for other languages. We got these from the Portland State Center, Population Center, Study Center. But yes, so we've got a dozen here just with regard to Spanish. But we can look at other languages as well.
Mm-hmm. And those are, if I can follow up, those are counties where 5% of the population is a native Spanish speaker?
Yeah, and I think that's the other part of this discussion is that we're really talking about across the state, and we're talking about communities, rural communities across the state that we would be reaching out to, as well as the metro areas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimbrough, just to go back to the APANO phone bank, what I think is very interesting, particularly for people who are naturalized citizens, is one of the concerns is sort of the basic about voting, and unfortunately, unless we have there's specifics, our citizenship classes provide new citizens with the opportunity to learn lots about America, including like how many original 13 colonies and the colors of the flag, et cetera. But as I reviewed the citizenship handbook recently, my recollection is there's very few questions about voting, and of course nothing about the specifics of voting in Oregon by mail and the secrecy of our ballot. And those are really key pieces for naturalized citizens, and I think we can do a better job about educating folks about our system than we're currently doing.
Okay. Further questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Where did, as you were putting this bill together, where did the language for qualifies? What have we got? 5%?
Right.
10,000 people. And then we've got something which I didn't understand about on an Indian reservation.
Right. If you'd Representative Jensen, Chair Hicks, that language comes from the federal policies, from the federal regulations. And quite honestly, I think the intent, our intent would be really to work with the communities and with stakeholders and develop our own definitions rather than following those federal guidelines. I think the state really has an opportunity to lead, and I think we can really look at that and develop our own guidelines.
Follow up?
Yes.
Sure.
What about the Native American or Indian population? I explain what that means.
Again, I think that was from the federal designation of minority populations. They talked about Hispanic and they talked about Native American populations. And again, I don't think we need to be tied to those definitions.
and we're talking about this on an Indian reservation?
If there's a language difference, we could. But frankly, I'm trying to think about Native American tribes here in Oregon. I don't think we'd have that problem. I don't think we'd have a 5% non-English speaking.
I can think of no reservation.
Yeah, I can't.
That.
It'd be nice if they did, but I don't think they do.
I'd like to say ask something else, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
But I see the Secretary of State, his body language tells me she wants to chime in on this, so I'd like to listen to what she has to say first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we're more than happy to work with the Commission on Indian Services to make sure that we are addressing native language requirements for the federally recognized tribes here in Oregon. So, but I suspect that's probably taken care of.
And I'm curious about where this, as we count these population, where this number of 5 years of age came from. I mean, we're talking about voting. We got a year or two to go before we get to voting status. Or reading. I mean, if you got a child reading what I would call junk mail, that is political mail, you probably are not going to have to worry about that child's reading skills when they get old enough to vote. So why 5 years of age used in,
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, again, that was just, we just lifted the federal guidelines, and I think that was part of their language, and it's certainly language that in our process we would really review that. So.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just editorial comment. I would certainly hope there would be additional work done on this, because the way it is currently written, I would have an extremely difficult time understanding what compelling reason there would be for me to support the bill. And I think I would be happy to, for this committee, show my voting record on these types of issues, and that I'm not opposed to minorities voting or any of those types of things. So, but those things just popped out at me as I can't understand.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I totally agree with you, and so does the Secretary. And our intent is really to basically redo the bill so that it does, as I said, so really reflects more of the reality here in Oregon and more of the intent that we really want to see. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And other questions at all? There being none. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next is Henry Kramer and Emma Callaway.
Chair Hicks, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Henry Kramer. I represent the Oregon Bus Project. We get young people and new people engaged in democracy and here to testify in favor of House Bill 3506. House Bill 3506 solves a real problem for the many American citizens in Oregon who don't use English as their primary language, but who eagerly, desperately want to be engaged and use their right and their responsibility to vote. It's about bringing our in our diverse communities, treating and embracing that diversity, and designing our democracy to meet the needs of the Oregonians who live in Oregon. For American citizens, and especially new American citizens, democracy should be an empowering experience. It's the way that we can truly show folks that this land is their land too. They can affect those decisions themselves. I've done a few things in my life more inspiring than helping a new citizen register to vote. It's an incredible experience. After a day of talking to disaffected skateboarders, it is really inspiring, which is most of it. In Oregon, we already give Spanish voter registration cards, which is further empowering for Spanish speakers. It shows that we want you to be here, and we want
the democracy that we have to work for you. But when that Spanish voter registration card is followed up by an English voter's pamphlet and an English ballot, it tamps down that empowering element a little bit. Which isn't to say we shouldn't have the Spanish voter registration cards. Those are excellent. They're a good first step. We just need to continue those steps. And we think that House Bill 3506 accomplishes that. I'd be happy to answer any questions. We're strongly in favor of the bill and urge your support.
And we'll hear from our next witness and then invite questions.
Thank you very much, Chair Hicks. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm here today to support House Bill 3506 with the understanding that as conversations move forward, we'd like to keep this as low cost as possible. That's important to college students. A member recently asked me why the Student Association and college students might support a minority language voter registration bill, and the answer is really quite simple. Student governments representing students in public schools around the state want students to be involved in the decisions that affect them. And what better way to do that than to engage in the political process? And in the last election, OSA registered over 50,000 young people to vote on college campuses. And every election cycle, we get questions about where voter registration information can be found in an alternative language. There's a common misconception that English fluency is a requirement to take any college class, but many students are taking English language learning classes on our college campuses, and this is especially true on our community college campuses. So if students are speaking a language other than English at home, student governments want those students to be able to be directed towards resources in their native languages. And personally, whenever I give a class presentation on voting, I always carry some Spanish voter registration cards with me, and I frequently give those out, and by doing so, I'm ensuring that that student has the same ease of access to registering to vote as the classmate sitting right next to them in Math 95. And I also know that by giving access to that information, I'm helping a student register to vote who is some of the least likely to register to vote on that campus. We know that language is a huge barrier to voting, and students want our county election offices to be able to provide the most accessible material. And we look forward to the discussion on this moving forward, and we'd be happy to participate in the process. So thank you, Chair Hicks, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Chair Hicks. I agree with almost everything you said, Emma. The one thing I would disagree with is, while it may be true that every student that OSA registered is younger than I wouldn't call everyone a young voter. Sure. There are, in fact, many older voters, first-time voters, actually, who were first registered to vote by the OSA, and I commend you for it.
Thank you. Okay, further questions for these witnesses? Okay, there are none. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Next are Doug Schmidt and John Charles.
Chair Hicks, members of the committee, my name is Doug Schmidt. I'm testifying today as a private citizen against this bill. I was reading some information, and it says to become a naturalized U.S. citizen, you must be at least 18 years of age, a legal permanent resident, and have a status of a legal permanent resident for 5 years before you can file. So that's 5 years of living in America that before you can even file to become a citizen. Again, I'm a second-generation American. My grandparents came over through Ellis Island, so I didn't have to learn English as my primary language. But I would think that after 5 years, plus whatever time it took to become a naturalized citizen, that people would have a basic understanding of English, at least to get by in this country. And America is a melting pot where people can come and they can keep their identity and who they are, but it's a melting pot where they're expected to blend and accept the laws of this country. And even though English isn't a law, I don't think, it is the language of America. And I would oppose this bill because I believe by the time you become an American citizen, you should have been in this country long enough to have learned the language. That's my personal opinion. That's it.
Okay, thank you. We'll have questions at the end of the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonpartisan policy research center. And I'm opposed to the bill, and I heard a previous proponent say, and I'll paraphrase here, I hope we can agree that all citizens should be able to vote in a language that is comfortable to them. And I respectfully disagree. What is comfortable to us as voters is not relevant. What's relevant is federal law. As a matter of federal policy, to be a citizen, you have to demonstrate proficiency in reading, writing, and speaking English. So if you're a citizen, you've already demonstrated that proficiency, why are we talking about the bill? If you can't demonstrate the proficiency, apparently you weren't ready for citizenship, so you should go back, but I don't think you have a moral claim on taxpayers' money to administer this bill. Now, as of 45 minutes ago, there was no fiscal, and it has to go to Ways and Means. I'm sure there is a fiscal, but anything more than $1, well, that's money that could go to other social purposes. So why would you appropriate money for this when a minimal requirement of being a citizen is proficiency in the language? So I hope before you vote on this, you simply focus on the policy question of, are the requirements of being a citizen important? Because if they are, that's the end of the conversation. The bill isn't necessary. Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel? Are there these witnesses? No, there are no. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And so are there any other witnesses on House Bill 3506? Anyone else for House Bill 3506? The public hearing for House Bill
30. Mr. Chair, yes, can I just make a point in response to what was just said? While the people were testifying, I looked at the website on the requirements for citizenship and naturalization, and there is an English language exemption for older students, older immigrants. If you're a permanent resident above age 50, then you are exempt from doing that English language test. And I'm just thinking of my own grandfather who, as I was growing up, he had been living in this country for many years. His spoken English was functional, but his reading comprehension and writing, you know, were not really. And I think he would have had a hard time reading our voters pamphlet, frankly, in English. So I sympathize with the concern here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dembrow. Any other? Okay. The public hearing on House Bill 3506 is closed, and the committee is going to stand in recess until some witnesses arrive on our next bills.
and open a work session on House Bill 2672A. Representative Gelser.
I've never seen a holder like this before. Hello, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. And you have before you House Bill 2672, which expands certain workplace protections for domestic workers, primarily, as we were talking about before the hearing started, nannies and housekeepers. You will notice that we have a very narrow definition of who domestic workers are. It's an individual who works in the home of another person for the purpose of caring for a child, doing housekeeping, or providing other domestic services. The Dash 7 amendment that we are asking for you to adopt further clarifies the change that we made in the Business and Labor Committee to exclude elder and companion care and care of the disabled by adding to that list of exclusions in that big B, those who are working for a home health care agency or similar organization. Oregon Healthcare Association is here to answer questions if you have questions about that. And then in the definition of domestic worker, we also add the clarification it does not include someone that is reimbursed through state funds. So this does not include any public workers. DHS and Oregon Healthcare Association and I feel confident that this keeps it pretty narrow to nannies and housekeepers. And I'm happy to explain more about what the bill does for nannies and housekeepers, if that is helpful to you at this point in time.
Are there any questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, words matter. And when you sat down, Representative, you said primarily nannies and housekeepers. I thought it was pretty exclusively nannies and housekeepers.
It could also be butlers.
Okay, well, when I get a butler, I'll...
it does matter, because we are talking about the narrowness of the applicability of this, and I wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you for the clarification.
All right, thank you, Representative. Is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on this bill before we move the amendment?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have the Dash A7 amendment. We have a no revenue impact. We received our fiscal impact statement just a little bit ago, so there is a paper copy in front of you right now. There is a statement on the measure.
There is.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2672A.
Representative Hoyle moves the Dash A7 amendment to House Bill 2672. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the adoption of the amendment? Hearing none, the motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2672A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
No.
Okay, no, Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 2672A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Last. I'm sorry, because it's coming at me fast. Can I ask Mr. Cheek to come up and explain the Dash 6 amendment?
Dash 7 or
6? 6.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 7 replaces the Dash 6.
Okay.
We're not using the Dash 6.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any further discussion on the motion to move the bill? Any objection?
I object.
Okay, Representative Kennemer's objection is noted for the record. Motion carries. House Bill 2672 is moved to the floor, and Representative Gelser will carry the bill.
Yes, thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2672, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3499. Representative Whitsitt.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3499 prohibits beneficiary or trustee or beneficiary's trustee's agent from selling or offering for sale real property acquired as a result of foreclosure unless tests of real property for contamination from methamphetamine manufacturing are completed and test results are disclosed in writing to prospective purchaser, permits purchaser that discovers that beneficiary or trustee or beneficiary's trustee's agent has not conducted test or has misrepresented results to rescind sale of property within 30 days after date of sale at no cost or penalty to the purchaser. Financial institution that is seller or will receive proceeds of sale of real property that financial institution acquired as custodian, agent, or trustee, or by foreclosure or deed in lieu of foreclosure is liable for any representation, misrepresentation, omission, error, or inaccuracy contained in the statement of disclosure. The measure becomes operative 91 days after effective date of act.
Okay, thank you. Representative Whitsitt, would you like to start the testimony and then you can introduce your constituents?
Thank you, Chair Garrett and committee members. My name is Gail Whitsitt and I'm the representative from Southern Oregon representing Southern Klamath and Lake Counties, House District 56. Oregon has been one of the states hit hardest by the methamphetamine problem, especially in the rural areas.
Only them.
He wanted to testify.
No, he did. Poor guy.
We outlawed the sale of pseudoephedrine several sessions ago in order to help curb the production of meth in our state, but we still have a methamphetamine problem. While the numbers of meth labs have decreased dramatically in recent years, meth cookers have found ways to circumvent our pseudoephedrine laws. The quote shake and bake method allows meth to be produced in smaller batches using only one box of cold medicine. I'm here today to bring forward a bill regarding the dispensation of private homes that were used in meth production in Oregon and that are now in foreclosure and or up for auction in the state. A little background on methamphetamine. Meth works by creating a surge of dopamine, which causes an intense rush of pleasure or prolonged sense of euphoria. Over time, meth destroys dopamine receptors, making it impossible to feel pleasure. Although these pleasure centers can heal over time, research suggests that damage to users' cognitive abilities may be permanent. Chronic abuse can lead to psychotic behavior, including paranoia, insomnia, anxiety, extreme aggression, delusions, hallucinations, and even death. Research by Dr. Richard Rawson of UCLA's Integrated Substance Abuse Program has determined that during methamphetamine use, the brain releases 12 times the volume of dopamine as a person would get from eating food or having sex or engaging in other activities humans enjoy. The dopamine released from meth is unlike any other experience the brain knows. For example, sex causes dopamine levels to jump to 100 to 200 molecular units, and cocaine causes them to spike to 350 units, while meth causes the release from a normal base level to about 1,250 units of dopamine. However, when the drug wears off, users experience profound depression and feel the need to keep taking the drug to avoid the crash. Meth, like all stimulants, causes the brain to release high doses of adrenaline, the body's fight or flight mechanism, inducing anxiety, wakefulness, and intensely focused attention called tweaking. Meth abuse causes the destruction of tissues and blood vessels, inhibiting the body's ability to repair itself. Blood vessels constrict, cutting off the steady flow of blood to all parts of the body. Meth users' teeth rot and fall out or break off at the gum line. In 2005, Minnesota Department of Corrections had a doubling of the cost of dental services over the previous 5 years due to extensive dental work performed on former meth addicts. In Oregon, the prevalence of crystal meth is believed to be the cause of recent rises in syphilis, and state health officials fear it may lead to a major rise in cases of HIV. Meth is extremely addictive in a very short period of time and very hard to kick. Some of the chemicals used in the production of methamphetamine include anhydrous ammonia, which is found in fertilizers, red phosphorus, which is found in matches, and lithium, which is found in batteries, among a plethora of dangerous and potentially deadly chemicals. Dr. Jeffrey Jenkins from Oregon State University's Environmental and Molecular Toxicology Department will testify more on this later. Homes used for meth production retain the residue of these chemicals. The residue has been found to cause illness in the residents now living in them. Often these are new purchasers who were not informed of the home's past. Allowable residue in a home in Oregon is 0.5 micrograms per square foot. Some homes have been found to contain from 50 to 70 times the amount of meth residue allowable under the law, even after remodeling. Oregon has a law in which homeowners are required to disclose if the home was used to produce dangerous drugs and would need the claim verified by the state health department. However, Oregon presently does not have mandatory testing or mandatory posted notice for foreclosed homes. For example, those homes whose original owners are no longer around to describe their knowledge of the home's past. These are the homes this bill is concerned with. A simple home testing kit for methamphetamine residue is available for a relatively small amount of money, about $50. This allows potential homeowners to test for the presence of meth residue and decide for themselves if they wish to purchase the home and then embark on a course to clean the meth house. I'm most concerned with those foreclosed houses which are now being auctioned to the public and which have no access by the public until the day before or the day of the auction. There is no way to determine meth residue by a potential buyer in that time frame. It would seem an important public health issue to either inform by posting on a foreclosed and or auction home a statement that the home has not been tested for methamphetamine or to actually test homes that do not have public access to their interiors prior to sale and let potential buyers know what they may be purchasing. I would like to introduce a young man and his family from Klamath County that have lived the nightmare of purchasing a family home from Freddie Mac that was contaminated with over 70 times the allowable amounts of meth, even after they sanded, cleaned, and remodeled the home to live in. His name is Jonathan Hankins next to me, and he will tell you his story. I have been asked to bring this bill forward for your consideration by Jonathan and his family. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead. Please just state your name for the record.
Chair Garrett and committee, thank you for having us here today. We are constituents in Representative Whitsitt's district. As she said, my name is Jonathan Hankins. I'm here with my beautiful wife, Beth, and our three-year-old son, who's in the back there, Ezra. Once again, thank you for taking this time to hear our testimony of why.
Thank you for the microphone to prayer. No, thank you.
Once again, thank you for taking this time to hear our testimony of why we are personally in support invested in House Bill 3499. Like many Americans and small business owners, my family has faced financial struggle due to the economy. We too have faced foreclosure with an upside down mortgage while my wife was a full-time nursing student and I tried to hold together a struggling business, during which we even lived with family to help alleviate financial pressure. We were ecstatic when my wife graduated with her RN license in summer of 2011 and acquired a full-time job where she continues working as an emergency room nurse. In 2012, we started pursuing the expansion of our family by means of adoption and started considering taking a chance at home ownership once again. We had been hit pretty hard by the economy and other unforeseen challenges in the years prior, but this was the year we were going to get back on our feet. We decided to research homes that were well within and even below our means in order to tackle our debts. We were even willing to take on projects that would need a little bit of work. We found some homes in the $30,000 to $40,000 range, which fit the budget we were going for. After our first offer was beat, we jumped on the only one left in our category. It was a foreclosed home with minimal defects, but the overall appearance was clean. The backyard had tons of potential for kids and there was room for expansion when needed. Our realtor and family carpenter confirmed that the structure of the house was sound and had good bones. Little did either of one of us know that these bones were toxic. After only 3 weeks of cleaning, painting, sanding, staining, and retiling, our family moved into our new cozy home. Our random collection of furniture fit perfectly. I will never forget the peaceful expression on my wife's face when she sat back with a sigh and said, after all we had been through, I finally feel like we are home. After living in our newly remodeled home for only 3 weeks, however, our home buying experience was starting to taste a little less sweet and a lot more bitter. It started when I started experiencing dry mouth, severe sinus headaches, followed by nosebleeds. Then Beth and Ezra were complaining of breathing problems and also discovered dry mouth, which developed into mouth sores. The final night we were in the house, Ezra, who was only 2 years old at the time, couldn't even take a drink of water because his mouth hurt so badly. He screamed in agony and threw the cup while trying to explain how badly his mouth hurt. The next morning, we packed our bags and moved back with Beth's parents. After our health symptoms improved, what followed in the coming weeks became even worse before it got better. After getting a tip from our neighbor that the former owners were probably cooking meth in what was now our home, we decided to call around and research and have it tested. We got a hold of a laboratory called ALS Laboratories out of Utah, and we acquired this, what's now a visual aid. If you don't mind, can I explain to you how simple it is to test it?
Go ahead.
I thought I was on an episode of CSI when we were doing this. It's so simple, even we can do it. I won't open this file, but I imagine it's simple rubbing alcohol. And you place this square here over the surface which you're testing. And you tear open this gauze. And you put this liquid on this gauze here, and you simply swipe inside the space that you're testing. We tested random interiors of our home and detected that our house had 38 micrograms per square foot of methamphetamine residue. The state of Oregon considers a home too contaminated to live in if only 0.50 micrograms per square foot are detected. We couldn't believe that this was possible after all of the scrubbing, the cleaning, and painting we had done. The costs we were quoted for cleanup were more than the house was even worth. We were aware of the dangers of lead-based paint and asbestos at signing, but nobody thinks to have the home tested for methamphetamine contamination or residue until they are facing the consequences that we were in. We began to research meth lab homes across the nation and were astonished to discover the countless cases where families have learned that the home they were living in was a former meth lab. Some of those families' members became extremely ill and even died due to the exposure. We learned that most of our belongings were most likely contaminated and that our homeowner's insurance didn't cover our losses because it was a pre-existing condition of the home. We even tried contacting Freddie Mac, who sold us the home, to discover the matter, and they didn't initially respond to any of our calls or emails. We contacted a lawyer who told us that we had no legal recourse because we bought the home in as-is condition. Even though Oregon is among 23 states that require full disclosure, companies like Freddie Mac are exempt from such laws because they don't have any prior knowledge of the home's history. Our realtor's lawyer even suggested that we default on our mortgage, allow the house to foreclose, and not disclose what we had discovered to our lender. Then we wouldn't be liable. When we asked what would happen if the lender foreclosed and sold the toxic home to another family, he told us that it would no longer be our problem. When we expressed that we just couldn't do that ethically, he said that it didn't matter, and according to the law, walking away quietly was our best and only option. We couldn't believe all that we were being told. Anyone we would talk to would say something similar, like, "I can't believe there aren't laws against something like this." After realizing that we were stuck, we decided to try to move forward with our lives again by renting another home while doing our best to keep up with the mortgage payments until we decided what we would do. Even though our best legal counsel was to walk away quietly, we wrestled with the reality that if we didn't say anything, our home buying nightmare would become someone else's nightmare. To us, sweeping this problem under the rug didn't seem like a good idea at all. I decided to start an online petition on change.org requesting the mortgage giant Freddie Mac begin testing their properties for methamphetamine contamination while paying for the cost of the cleanup of our home and for our losses. Realizing that it was most likely that nothing would happen, we at least wanted to share about our family's experience while warning future homebuyers of the dangers of methamphetamine contamination. Somebody needed to tell homebuyers what realtors and title companies weren't willing to say. Little did we know that our story would get so much attention. After our petition went viral, collecting over 200,000 signatures, it has been featured on several national media outlets, including Yahoo News, Huffington Post, The Drudge Report, CNN, Inside Edition, World News with Diane Sawyer, Anderson Cooper Live, and ABC's 2020. Thanks to our petition supporters, we were finally able to get the attention of Freddie Mac. After several months, we have recently come to an agreeable settlement on our house, and Freddie Mac has agreed to review and update their policies to ensure the safety for home buyers in the future. although they didn't feel legally obligated, they felt ethically responsible because the house was in their possession for an entire year while it was only in our possession for 1 month. Although this is good news for our family and potentially for Freddie Mac customers in the future, we will remain tireless advocates for the sake of families and future homeowners. Some have told us that the methamphetamine epidemic is no longer a concern in Oregon since we have successfully restricted access to pseudoephedrine. Thank you. My wife's a nurse. She can tell me. But meth addicts and producers of this horrifying drug will tell you otherwise. My wife, Beth, is a nurse who sees meth addicts in the emergency room on a regular basis. She sees the costly effects of those, even youth, who have already had their innocence wrecked by this horrible drug. But even if those who say that meth is no longer a problem in their communities, how many homes are contaminated with the toxic residue? According to a Yahoo News article on October 1st, 2012, regarding the problem with meth-contaminated homes, they said, it's a catch-22 that Joe Mazuka of Meth Lab Cleanup, a national remediation and training company, predicts others could find themselves in. Based on national and state data, Mazuka conservatively estimates there are 2.5 million meth-contaminated homes in the United States. The signs and indicators aren't always there, he said. You don't always see the meth residue. It's extremely dangerous stuff. His concern was echoed at a congressional hearing in August on the efforts to curb domestic methamphetamine production. Drug czar Gil Kurilowski, head of the President's Office of National Drug Control Policy, testified that U.S. meth lab seizure has more than doubled between 2007 and 2010. And these labs pose a major threat to public safety and the environment. Mazuka said the problem is off the charts. We average a call every 3 to 5 minutes. One of those recent calls came from Michigan, a state with no disclosure law, where a father unknowingly purchased a meth-contaminated home. He just buried his 14-year-old daughter after living in it for only 2 years. Mazuka said, I could tell you stories like that for days. With or without disclosure laws, Mazuka believes scores of home buyers are at risk because only 1 in 10 meth labs are busted. Other times, he said, information can fall through the cracks by the time a big bank or government agency gets past the red tape of selling a foreclosed home. When my mother read this article, she called me and began to cry, not yet fully comprehending the depth of what we were walking through. She said, what happened to that man's 14-year-old daughter? I could have been saying the same about you, Beth, or my grandson. Buyer beware doesn't mean the same thing as it did when the term was first originated. The man in Michigan and countless of other families like ours shouldn't have to be surprised and confined by such standards in the midst of uncovering such a horrifying reality and grieving our losses. It is essential that future home buyers know of these dangers firsthand. We ask you to approve House Bill 3499 so that future families in Oregon don't have to experience the nightmare my family and thousands of others have faced. House Bill 3499 would require sellers to post a notice of warning if the house has not been tested for the deadly residue of methamphetamine contamination. We have been mocked by some that we didn't do our due diligence as home buyers. How could we if the sellers aren't doing theirs? Now all we are asking is for the state to do their due diligence by eliminating the risks of such environmental hazards from being bought as homes for Oregonians. Now that we know better, together hopefully we can do better. Thank you for hearing our story and considering our requests.
Thank you very much. Beth, did you want to testify as well?
I didn't prepare anything, so I think you kind of covered all of it.
All right, are there questions for the panel? Representative Berger.
Representative, thank you. And thank you for bringing this. This is one of those horror stories. The bill itself, I'm reading it and I'm trying to understand, is it only for foreclosed homes?
Yes.
So if you bought a home that wasn't foreclosed, presumably you would, I mean, the same thing could happen, could it not?
I would assume it could, but the buyer would be, the seller would be responsible then. It's my understanding under ORS for divulging that the house had been used before.
Ah, that's why the, okay, that explains it. Why? Because you would, it would be the responsibility of the seller under current law to divulge this, but in a foreclosure situation. Ah, got it.
Got it. Thank you.
Representative Kenner.
I guess just a comment. Yeah, this closes a huge loophole in this as-is sale. And, you know, it sounds pretty good that you can buy a house for a little or nothing, but you take it as-is. The problem is what is beyond repair, so, or pretty much so.
Yeah.
Representative Jensen.
Sure. My heart certainly goes out to you and to hundreds, literally, of other people who have experienced the same type of situation. The one thing, you are fortunate. You're fortunate that you were smart enough to investigate it early, you know, before permanent damage was done. And my congratulations to you for, you know, for your diligence and for your uncompromising position to proceed, you know, with this. I am disheartened by the fact that, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, time slips by pretty quickly if you're having as much fun as we have in the legislature sometime. And when we passed the no cooking meth bill and made that the end, put all the chemical or chemicals behind the shelf where easy access to large supplies were not easy, not available for people. I was always real happy because in my county, my district, which is Pendleton, Umatilla County, we were the meth cooking capital of the state of Oregon. Not necessarily something that appeared in the Chamber of Commerce brochures, but you know, I have seen a number of houses that were literally destroyed by people cooking meth in them. So an ability to close down, you know, the cooking, even though I wasn't naive enough to think it would close down the meth traffic, the ability to close it down and keep young children like your son from becoming addicted to meth before they were even old enough to talk, I felt was probably one of the greatest achievements that I had been a part of, here in the Capitol. And now you've come to us with a story that, and thanks to Gail and her, finding you or you finding her and you guys getting together and working, you know, on this. And you come to us with a story that we have just begun to fight to eradicate this drug from our homes. And I'm sorry it was you that happened to be the person who had to do this, but I am very grateful that you've had the courage, and I know it's taken a lot of courage, to do what you've done since you discovered this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I really appreciate you, sticking to this and your advocacy to expose this, and instead of walking away like maybe you were told to walk away and keep it quiet. It seems egregious to me that you would get that kind of advice from industry professionals to start with. I'm kind of curious, Representative, and I know Legislative Council is sitting here. I'm curious whether there's any loopholes in this and whether this sorts of disclosure will be required on the sale of all property. I know that was something that was alluded to by Representative Berger, but I'm concerned that this doesn't cover enough.
Perhaps I could bring up Legislative Council, Sean, if you would be kind enough.
Yes. And I apologize for not getting this question to you in advance.
Appreciate that. Representative Chair Garrett and members of the committee, Sean Brennan from Legislative Council. To address your question, Representative Holvey, the bill is directed primarily at foreclosed homes and does not purport to go beyond that scope. As to whether there are disclosures required of other sales, I would have to review the statutes to be sure. I think there are requirements for disclosures between private sellers and private buyers that do require a fair amount of disclosure in terms of, in fact, I'm fairly sure looking back into my memory now, looking at the statute, I think there is a specific requirement for methamphetamine disclosures. But again, to be absolutely sure, I'd want to review that statute.
Somewhere in the testimony, it's in our staff measure summary. It says Oregon is one of 27 states with a meth disclosure law pertaining to home sale. I assume that's between private parties.
Mm.
Is that right, Aaron?
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification.
Representative Denbrough had a question?
No, actually, it was the same one that Rep. Holvey asked.
Representative Jensen?
Just a comment on the last topic. I think one of the places that one might look at would be the automobile industry, used cars in particular, instead of having the meth lab in a fixed place, they put roving mixed labs using cars to. Probably many of those cars are going to wind up as in the junkyard. But by the same token, they go to the junkyard and are stripped down. And parts of those vehicles, like seats, are sold back to the public. So it certainly would be an industry that I would be anxious to look at.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Whitsitt? We have two more witnesses on this bill. Thank you, Representative, very much.
Thank you. I had just a couple statistics. It's very hard to get an actual grasp of how many homes are in foreclosure in Oregon right now, but data for 30 counties, Oregon County, shows over 800 homes currently scheduled for auction, and a lot of those will not have access to the interior at all. They will be sold essentially as is without the ability to check. And then Oregon currently has a foreclosure inventory of approximately 2,000 properties. Now, I don't know, these are just the figures that we've been able to sort of glean, but there isn't a lot of information out there. When you try and pin down the actual numbers, it's very difficult to find exactly. This is what we found to give you an idea of what we're looking at in scope. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you.
Sean, did you have a
comment? Chair Garrett, if I could just address the question. I did actually locate a statute in response to Representative Holvey's question that I think does address his question. In ORS 105-464, there's a form set out for seller's disclosure for properties. In the general disclosures under that form on, I guess it would be page 438 of volume 10, oh, excuse me, volume 3 of the ORS, there actually is a requirement that the seller disclose whether the property has ever been used as an illegal drug manufacturing or distribution site. So that's an existing disclosure. Part of what this bill does is remove the exemption that financial institutions have from making that disclosure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
I'm not sure if the toxicologist came or not.
He's here.
Oh, okay. Great. We do
Jeffrey Jenkins. Please come forward.
Thank you.
Chairman Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Jenkins. I'm a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State, House District 16, and I was asked by Representative Witsit to give some, I guess, expert testimony as a toxicologist on the magnitude of these meth manufacturing facilities on homes. This is, I think, rather anticlimactic and maybe not even necessary based on the testimony you've already heard. But a lot of the talk or the discussion up till now has been about meth. A little bit about how it's manufactured. The representative mentioned lithium, red phosphorus, some other ingredients. EPA has recently put together a publication that I relied heavily on called Voluntary Guidelines for Methamphetamine Laboratory Cleanup. This was published in March of this year. This document was put together in conjunction with all the states that are currently involved, all the state health departments, departments of environmental quality, and others across the country that are concerned about cleaning up meth facilities. In this document, they highlight four different ways of producing meth, and that comprises about over 50 different chemicals, for which we don't have a lot. This is in addition to the final product, methamphetamine, that we really don't have a lot of information about toxicologically. A lot of them are common products. I mean, lithium's found in batteries. Red phosphorus is found in matches. Acetone is on the list. It's found in fingernail polish remover. But when you take these ingredients as mixtures, and instead of having a little vial of acetone that you might use to remove fingernail polish, you put a few gallons of that or gallons of that on a stove, and you add other ingredients to it, and you heat it up. And then that starts permeating a home with not only the volatile organics, but it's a carrier for all the other components. Truly, it can take a home and in not too much time turn it into a hazardous waste site. And if this were a meth lab, this room, the carpeting would be saturated with chemicals. These ceiling tiles that are designed to deaden sound are porous. They would be full of residues. And then someone comes back into that home after it's no longer a meth lab, and those chemicals off-gas into the environment. Children crawling around on the carpet. The residues get transferred, and they're very good at putting their hands in their mouth, and a lot of these chemicals are absorbed through your skin. So it's this issue not only about meth, but about all the ingredients that are used to produce meth. EPA has estimated that for every pound of meth, there's 7 pounds of waste produced. And it's a matter of volume. And it's a matter of combined toxicity. This is about as serious as I can think of an event that could happen in a home with regards to the potential for toxic exposure. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you very much. Any questions? We appreciate your Representative Barnhart. Please.
Just very quickly, just in very, very general terms, what does it take to clean up a home like this, and how successful is it? Can you be to do that? Would it be possible for a young family like this to move back into a house like that?
You know, under the most, it sounds like, based on what was described today that I heard in testimony, where they came back in after the house had supposedly been cleaned and did a wipe test and tested for such high residues, this guide the EPA just put out based on their consultation with the states would suggest that you would take that house down to the studs. If all new wallboard, all new ceiling. If you saw any sort of stains on the studs, you might even take the studs out. And so now you're talking about virtually taking the house down.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, it's very similar then to a situation after a bad flood.
Yes.
Thank you.
And the carpeting comes up always, almost always the carpeting comes up. If the subfloor is porous and there's any signs of staining, the subflooring comes up.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your being here today. We have one final witness, Tim Martinez, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I'd hope to be joined by some of my colleagues in the business, but it looks like I'm the one that's going to leave the table crying today. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and what happened to those folks in Klamath Falls and others around the country is certainly a tragedy, and there ought to be something that we can do to address that issue. Representative Whitsitt, who brought this bill earlier this year, I've been working with her since the start of session, and we're going to continue to work together. I think the bill that you have in front of you today is unlikely to be the final language. Because we are trying to see if there isn't something that we can put together. I think, as has been mentioned earlier, there's a couple issues here. First of all, you know, these houses, if they are, you know, foreclosed on and sold at a sheriff's sale or through an auction house, as was mentioned, are sold as is. And the primary reason for that is that they belong to the borrower until they're sold. So therefore, we don't have the ability to go into that house. We don't have the ability to test that house for anything. That's an example why financial institutions are exempt from the seller's disclosure, because we don't know what's in that house any more than the buyer does. So that's really the big question. How do we legally get the ability to look at that house and check that house? And again, as I say, we are working with the sponsor. And in this particular instance, when you're talking about meth, it's very unlikely that whoever that owner still is going to say, go ahead and test it for meth if they've been cooking meth in that house. So that's not going to happen. So that makes, you know, the existing law difficult to comply with. Or not difficult, it makes it like they're highly unlikely. As I say, we are working with the sponsor. Which some of the ideas we're kicking around is to somehow broaden the announcement and the information what an as-is sale means, you know, so that folks going in there know exactly what they're getting or not getting, and can be, you know, make that determination whether or not they want to buy the property at that point. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I guess the last thing I would say before you have questions is that it's, you know, I think the folks in Klamath Falls said that this house had been owned by Freddie Mac for a year. So it's unclear to me whether the house was purchased through a real estate agent or was purchased at a sale. So I think that information would be helpful as we go to try to find a solution for this problem. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What kinds of disclosures and inspections are customarily done in a foreclosed property situation?
Again, we don't, and it's kind of the same, sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's kind of the same issue we face that we've discussed in this building for the last several sessions on maintaining properties that are going through the foreclosure process. Again, until the house has reverted back to the lender, the lender does not have the ability to go into that house or to generally, you know, do any upkeep outside the house. You know, they have, you have a contract with them, they have a contract with you, and part of that is you will not come into that house uninvited, whether they've left the town or the state. That's our problem. We can't get into that house legally. And what we have seen in other states is if people do, if lenders do go into the house, then occasionally we get sued for that. And that's just not a risk that most lenders are willing to take.
But does a buyer, though, have a right to do an inspection as a condition of closing as they would in a private sale?
No, because it is an as-is sale.
Okay, any other questions?
And if I can just add, Mr. Chair, you know, generally speaking, at a sale, many of these, you know, the lender may not be there in person. They may have submitted a bid online for what's owed on the house. It's my understanding in talking to folks that do this that a lot of times there are very few people that actually show up beyond the lender.
Representative Dembro.
Well, actually, the information that we just heard may preclude this remedy. But, you know, we had heard that to do a test would cost about $50 or so. I mean, if the bank could do that test, is that an amount that's too steep to bear? I mean, I don't know what the carrying costs are for this kind of sale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, members of the committee, no, again, it's not a cost issue. It's a liability issue. You know, the cost at $50, you know, is fairly minimal. It is a liability issue. I will tell you, since you opened the door, if a bank has a house in foreclosure, once that borrower stops making the payments, the servicer continues to make that payment, in this case it would have been Freddie Mac, and continues to make that payment on behalf of the borrower. So those costs continue to accrue. If there's any taxes that are due, the servicer pays those taxes. If there's insurance, they pay that too. Once the foreclosure sale is done and you have a final dollar amount that you have into that house as a servicer, you go back to the, in this case, Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae or whoever it might be, and say, this is how much money we spent during the foreclosure process. And generally speaking, it's my understanding that the servicer then gets about 60 cents on the dollar. So, you know, they are generally losing a fairly significant amount of money on these foreclosures as the servicer. But having said all that, no, $50 is certainly not an unreasonable sum. And again, we are trying to work with the sponsor to see if there isn't a way to make this work that doesn't, cause us or cause the banks any additional liability issues, but gets the answers that we're all looking for.
Senator Holby.
Thank you. Ms. Martinez, I can appreciate the scenario you described where the lender or the beneficiary doesn't actually have title to the property, but they do initiate a foreclosure process and have generally a security interest in the property and in a lien position on the property, and then they execute go forward with the foreclosure process and the sale, so they're actually, you know, helping the sale along the way. And though you aren't the owner and don't have, in your words, a right to go in and test the property, and it's an as-is sale, it seems the state could pass a law and just say, you know, all properties that are sold need to be tested for methamphetamines, and it wouldn't really matter whether you were the title owner or security interest holder or whatever. And so, I mean, how would that not make it legal for you to have the house tested before you go through the process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, members of the committee, I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to practice law here. But again, it would be you would be violating the contract that you have with the borrower. And I would think, frankly, that consumer groups would not want the lender to have the ability to go into their house. That's what you're suggesting would happen, is that the lender would be able to go into their house and do this testing. And I'm not sure. I'd have to do some more research. I'm happy to do that to see how the secondary market, Fannie and Freddie, and others would look at that type of statute. I can't answer that.
Representative Berger.
We're thinking, because we agree there's a problem here, and so a solution should be, and clearly you have spoken to Representative Whitsitt. What about this as-is language? Could you say a property sold as-is is as-is except as it's been tested for a drug manufacturer? And that would be the one as-is exception, and so somebody could buy it or say they're going to buy it as-is pending this test.
Representative Garrett, Representative Berger, members of the committee, that's certainly something that we could take a look at. That's not been one of the issue or one of the ideas that we've talked about with the sponsor so far, but it certainly is an issue we could take a look at. I think the bigger issue is going to be with the Fannie, Freddie, and others that are ultimately going to be the owners of the house. One of the things we've talked about with the sponsor is making it very clear at the sale that it's as is, and not, and specifically mentioning meth, because again, that discovery is more than likely going to be a surprise to the person that made the loan, to the lender and the servicer. They certainly don't make loans to folks who are going to break the law intentionally. But we are certainly open to all ideas, and we'll be looking and working with the sponsor on that. And like I say, I hope to get others in the real estate industry involved in these discussions as well.
Was there a follow-up? Representative Holby? I'm sorry, Representative Jensen had a question. We'll come back to you in a moment.
Fine. Mr. Martinez, is there a window of time between when you legally cannot go into the house to when you legally could go into the house before a next transaction was made? Be that a very small window or be that a larger window?
Chairman Garrett, Representative Jensen, members of the committee, when you say going, who's going in the house, the lender, the new owner, or?
The lender.
No, because I believe the answer is no. Again, I'll confirm that. But, at the sale, until the sale is complete, again, the borrower is the owner of the home. As soon as that sale is complete, then, for example, in many cases, the lender is the only a bidder, and they then generally sell that house through a realtor and go through the typical process of selling a house.
Well, and I'm not at all disagreeing with your standard position on you have no right to go in, no legal ground. And I know that you face if you do go in, you face potential liabilities far exceeding the value of the house, potentially. So it's the type of thing that any lender would have to be extremely cautious about, that you didn't do that. But if it's a foreclosure, Is there a time that you, the lender, are the owner of the house when you have foreclosed on it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, members of the committee, again, it's my understanding that, let's say I'm in foreclosure, okay, and tomorrow they're going to sell my house. I have up until the sale the ability to redeem that house. I can come in and say, here's all the money, and the lender may indeed say, okay, you know, we're all squared, don't miss any more payments. But it's got to be everything to get me whole, or get the lender whole. If I don't do that, then the house at that sale, once the sale is complete, is no longer mine. It may be the lender if they're the one that ended up buying it back, or it may be a third party that's come in and bought that house as a investment. So the answer is I don't believe so. I think it goes from the borrower to whoever the next purchaser is.
I just have some difficulty with somebody else, whether it's the lender or another real estate or a real estate type of operation, going in and buying a house in the day and age we live in without checking it out for meth first. I mean, that certainly would not be something that I would do. Or
sure. Well,
but that's I. And the you know, is the potential answer to this. If I can use the automobile industry as an example, since I've mentioned it in relationship to the possibility of meth. When a car is sold, and especially a used car, there's a lot of extra money to be made, yes, but a lot of money to be made by the dealership selling you a contract that you will stand good for any repairs that the owner would stand good, or the insurance company would stand good for any repairs. Any possibility that type of thing might be financially feasible?
Chair, Representative Jensen, members of the committee, you know, there certainly are companies that sell not home insurance as far as fire and flood and stuff, but do sell home warranties. Yeah. Again, I don't know if there's anybody that does that at a foreclosure sale, because again, I never say 100%, but I would say 99.99% of these sales are just simply sold as is.
Is that? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
But I've got to ask or make an observation on one. Is that just kind of picking up on the young man's, advice from the real estate agency? You know, the best thing to do is to walk away from it. Is that the, the advice that that we're going to give the lending institutions? Hurry up and sell this to somebody else so that you don't have to deal with the problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, members of the committee, I sure hope that's not the impression I'm leaving you with.
Well,
the impression I'd like to leave you with is the fact that we don't know what's in that house any more than the potential buyer does. You know, we have not had access to that house. So, we don't know what we're going to find in it. In this day and age, you go into those houses and you find everything that isn't nailed down taken out. You find them graffiti all over the walls. You find holes punched. I mean, we don't know what's in there until we get into that house either.
So we have one more item on our agenda, so I want to wrap this up, but we had Representative Holvey and Representative Kennemer. Can you make it brief?
I'll go ahead and hold my thoughts.
Okay.
Or question.
All right.
I'll be happy to.
Representative Kennemer.
Mr. Chairman, I guess more comment. I've served on business committee now for 14 years, and these procedures have been carefully crafted over literally centuries. They're not easily changed without shifting something. It's a tough sell.
Representative Holvey.
I'll just make a comment, because it is sort of confusing, but I've walked through foreclosed properties with realtors that have been foreclosed by a bank, and
you know, and looking to buy them, you know, and so I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the access issue. And then on the flip side of that, when the beneficiary has a lien position on the title and has some sort of ownership as a result of that, and in fact, when somebody buys a foreclosed property, the title usually comes from the beneficiary on a foreclosed property. It does not. You know, so I mean the semantics of who owns and who controls the property, I think, are maybe vague at best, and certainly I don't see anything that would prevent the legislature from passing a law and says, you know, you need to have these homes tested for methamphetamine if you're going to sell them. So, thank you.
Well, I understand that you are working with the sponsor of the bill. I'm detecting a high level of interest on the committee in doing something to address this issue, so I'm going to ask at least one member of the committee to work with you on putting together a bill that can actually move and that addresses some of the legitimate concerns that you've raised on behalf of the industry. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3499. Before we get to the HTM 15, I want to reopen a work session on House Bill 2672, and I'm asking the chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Hicks to change his vote on House Bill 2672A. As amended by the A7 amendment, it will not change the outcome of the vote taken. Is there any, this motion is not debatable. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hicks, how do you vote?
Nope.
Votes no. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2672. And I will open the work session on House Bill 26, pardon me, HJM 15. Did I say work session? Let me just start over. I will open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 15. Representative Hoyle, Representative Clem, and Kevin Card, please. Thank you for your patience.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, HJM 15 urges Congress to support passage of Postal Service Protection Act of 2013. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact on the memorial.
Everybody's being so nice. Thank you very much for taking the time to hear this bill. This is a House Joint Memorial, and normally I really dislike memorials, resolutions. I'm not a big fan of them, but this one is, it's essential and important.
Chair, who is she for the record?
Oh, sorry. My name is Val Hoyle. I'm the state representative from West Eugene and Junction City, House District 14 in beautiful Lane County. So we're here today to ask for your support on House Joint Memorial 15. We have bipartisan support. This is chief co-sponsored by myself, Representative Clem, and Senator Ted Ferrioli. What this does is it urges Congress and our delegation to support the passage of the Postal Service Protection Act of 2013. H.R. 630 in the House, which is sponsored by Congressman Peter DeFazio, or Senate Bill 316, sponsored by Senator Bernie Sanders. And what this says is we would protect six-day delivery, eliminate that the requirement that the U.S. Postal Service make 75 years worth of retiree health care benefit payments to its pension plan. The Postal Service right now is required to prepay its pension and health plan 75 years in advance for people who haven't been born yet, never mind be employed by the Postal Service. The Postal Service receives no tax dollars for its operations. However, it is under the authority of Congress. So what this does is it will result in closures of a number of post offices and distribution centers. Salem, very shortly, our Springfield Distribution Center, in 2014. And so if you were to mail a letter from Brookings to Gold Beach, it would have to go to Portland first. If we would mail a letter, or more importantly, if we were to mail a ballot from Eugene to go to Lane County elections, it would go to Portland before it would come back. Because we're a vote-by-mail state, every post office is a ballot box, and so I think it's even more essential that in Oregon we keep the integrity of the Postal Service. And so we would appreciate your support on this memorial. And with that, I'll turn it over to my good colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem District 21. And given that five of you are already co-sponsor of this bill and the hour's late, I won't really spend any time on this except to just say I'm involved with it, A, because the Salem Postal Facility that Representative Hoyle just mentioned is in my district, and B, my dad was a letter carrier for 42 years, and so I kind of have the Postal Service in my blood. And it's not that the Postal Service hasn't had to learn how to innovate and figure out how to change its business model due to email and other things, but the artificial limitations on it, like the pre-funding, is a real problem that it's hard to innovate your way out of something like that. And that's why I'm hopeful Congress will act. Not sure if they will in time for Salem, but I certainly hope so, and have been urging our congressional delegation to do that personally and privately, but it'd be nice if we could also do that as a body. And then let's get over to Kevin, probably. He's the important one here.
Thank you.
My name is Kevin Card. I am been a letter carrier in beautiful downtown Lake Oswego. I was Representative Garrett's mailman when he first moved into his house on First Street. And I represent the letter carriers all across the state of Oregon who deliver to every business and address in this state in one of the most efficient postal systems in the world, if not the most efficient. And I'm here to just urge your support for this, and I really appreciate the fact that the Oregon delegation, that you folks have decided to take this up, because we are at a crisis point with the Postal Service. If you know any bit about the legislative history of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, that is requiring us to spend billions of dollars, over $5 billion a year, to pre-fund future retiree health care benefits far into the future, you'll understand that what we have with the Postal Service right now is a manufactured crisis, but it affects everybody in this country, and especially people in this room. I spoke with a letter carrier in Baker City this afternoon who was just informed that any mail they don't get back to the post office by 3 o'clock in the afternoon will not get processed till the next day. The next day, that mail will be taken all the way to Portland and get sorted back. So no longer will you be in a position in most of Oregon to put a letter in the mail in your hometown and expect it to get delivered across the street the next day, as we've been doing for over 200 years. Mm. And it's important right now that we deal with this issue, because right now service is being degraded in every community in this state. The Salem plant is closing down as of June 1st. All of Salem's mail, which goes anything in the 973 zip code all the way down to the coast, is going to come all the way to Portland and get back. Every service is being degraded as we speak. So I appreciate Representative Hoyle's action on this, and I would appreciate this making through the legislature so we can get support for this nationwide.
Thank you, and it's good to see you again. And thank you for my always punctual mail service. Any questions? Representative Jensen.
Just a comment. If you don't think the Postal Service in the United States is efficient and effective, go to Canada. It'll take you to get it from Richmond to Vancouver, somewhere between a week to 10 days.
We'll have to open a work session. Would you like to come back so you can vote on this? I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 15.
Thank you.
And I'm going to open a work session on HJM 15. And I would take a motion, Ms. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that HJM 15 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves HJM 15 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, motion passes. Carry will be Representative Hoyle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you again. And our committee's adjourned. 5 o'clock.